The Honolulu Rail Project will be funded, at least for the moment, thanks to a bill that is about to pass at the state legislature. And if a compromise is defined as a deal that no one involved is completely happy with, this might just be it. Some questions arise. Are we done worrying about this? Are we now going to get a train that runs all the way to Ala Moana Center? HPR's political reporter Wayne Yoshioka is with us to close the latest chapter in a long-running drama. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, Chris. You know that Senate Bill 4 just sailed through the special session unchanged?
Mm-hmm.
What they proposed to do was to, you know, extend the GET for 3 years.
Right.
And that should raise, about $1.3 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also going to raise the transit accommodations tax 1% to 10.25%, and that should raise another $1 billion. So here we have a deal to raise almost $2.4 billion for the rail project.
Which is estimated by most to get us there, right?
Right. And I think the whole scene behind all this legislation was really to get the legislators to understand that the general excise tax is very important to the state, and we can't give that up to the counties for 10 years until 2037.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think if you look at it, how this legislation went through, in the months that intervened between the end of the session in May to the beginning of the special session, a lot of lawmakers were convinced that, hey, we can't have the counties have a pass and not get into their coffers, which is their tax powers in terms of the transit accommodation tax and the property taxes that they collect from all these resorts.
Right now, the county's share of the transit accommodations tax, even with the 1%, part of the deal of having it be increased 1%, is to freeze the county share at $103 million. Not at a percentage of the visitors they bring in, but at that flat figure.
Correct.
And in perpetuity, right, as
right.
The bill is written.
They raised it. They gave the counties $10 million more,
yeah.
But they froze it for 13 years until 2030.
Mm-hmm.
So that really ties their hands in terms of using tourist-based economies or property taxes.
One of the things that this seems to have produced, Wayne, is a real division between the interests of Oahu and the neighbor islands. And a lot of neighbor island legislators have been pretty vocal about that.
And I think they should be, but they didn't see the big picture in terms of preserving the general excise tax for the state. And I think Manoa Representative Isaac Choi probably explains it the best on what the legislature really did.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember the earlier arguments on why we didn't want to extend the 0.5% GET for the rail, the argument was the leadership of the House felt that there's a capacity of how much you can tax taxpayers, and that 0.5% going strictly to rail limited them from raising taxes for other state needs. And now what we're doing is we're increasing the TAT by 1% on neighbor islands, limiting the counties from taxing those resorts or tourist-related properties on real property taxes or fees or anything else on those particular entities that are affected by this 1%.
So basically what the legislature did was they froze the transit accommodations tax for 13 years,
right.
Meaning that the counties couldn't really tax resorts and commercial property even more. And so, you know, it basically freezes them in terms of having their tax powers and to raise money for their county needs. And I can understand why the counties were just so adamant about not touching the TAT.
With that fixed figure of $103 million, $103 million is going to mean a lot less 13 years from now.
Correct. And you figure they extended it 13 years, and the transit accommodations tax is going to bring in only $1 billion, whereas the GET, extending it for 3 years, brings in $1.5 billion. So the GET is a much more powerful financial stream.
It's also, in general, excise taxes are roundly criticized as regressive and affecting those with little money, you know, doing more harm to them than people with plenty of money.
And I think House Speaker Emeritus Joe Suki puts it this way. He says, you know, if people have money, they'll travel. but people have to eat and pay for their medical medicine, and that's why the GET is much more powerful.
Yeah. Well, the question that arises at the end of the day, it would seem, is have we just gone to the, you know, have we emptied out the piggyback bank for future needs, either from the county's needs, neighbor island needs, you know, what is the next Hurricane Iniki going to do to us?
Yeah, that's all, you know, in the pot right now. But I think the biggest message that the legislature made to the counties was that the TAT is a state tax, and we can give it and we can take it away. And that's the big message that came out during the special session.
That's going to have a lot of repercussions politically because it's a pretty polarizing message, isn't it?
And the counties, you know, that's their only source of revenue.
Yeah.
It's property taxes. And if you freeze that for them, it's like they're in a no-win situation.
Well, a few days ago, you heard my discussion with Council Chair Raposo on Kauai saying, you know, what are we going to – where's the incentive for us to attract tourism, upgrade our infrastructure, take care of our parks to attract more visitors when there's nothing to be gotten from that, right?
But they are getting $10 million more, and, you know, it's not much, but at least it's in perpetuity.
That $10 million more is a restoration of an earlier figure, though.
Oh, of course. I mean, that goes back to...
It just takes them back to what they were getting, 10 years ago.
It's not even the cost of living for any intents and purpose.
Well, that's what makes me think, Wayne, that we're not done hearing about this, that we've got some divisions that have been created within the structure of, you know, county, state government, county versus state government. We're likely to hear a lot more about that, especially in the next election cycle, wouldn't you think?
And we're going to go and we're going to hear more and more about Airbnb and the internet hospitality sector. And there's going to be a lot more pressure to get them to pay some of that TAT.
Whether or not we're able to collect from that
correct
sector, a growing sector, right?
Correct.
When money's on the line, there's always a lot of confusion, isn't there, Wayne?
There is. There is a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Wayne Yoshioka is HPR's political reporter.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we'll look at modernist architecture in Cambodia and Lihue. But first, your quiz.
As we celebrate architecture in our communities today, we'll take a look at an Art Deco-inspired structure located off the shores of Kapi'olani Park, the Waikiki Natatorium War Memorial. It was completed in 1927 and mirrored the Hawaiian Beaux-Arts architectural style, a form of neoclassicism that combines ancient Greek and Roman architectural styles and principles into a modern form. Inside is a 140-meter saltwater swimming pool. It was created to honor the 10,000 men from Hawaii who volunteered to serve in the First World War. The opening ceremonies that were held on August 24, 1927, included local Olympic gold medalist Duke Kahanamoku taking the first dip in the pool. That seemed all too perfect because it was Duke's birthday. The architect who created the memorial studied at the American Academy in Rome and the National School of Fine Arts in Paris. For today's quiz, can you tell us the name of this architect? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. The first one with the correct answer gets the HPR tote, letting everyone know you got it right.
Thank you. Tonya Moy is vice president with Fung Associates, an architecture and design firm known for preservation, particularly of mid-century modern design in Hawaii. She's a member of Doko Momo, an international organization that celebrates modernist architecture. Welcome, Tonya.
Thanks, Noe.
And William Chapman is here. He's an award-winning expert in historic preservation. He consults for national and international organizations and heads the Historic Preservation Graduate Program at UH Manoa. Recently, Dr. Chapman completed a book on ruins in Southeast Asia, and he's here to introduce us to the amazing modernist period in Cambodian architecture.
Thank you, Noah.
Bill, thanks very much for coming on in here. You know, people might be more familiar with images of ancient Cambodian, those turreted stone things. Introduce us to the 20th century.
Yeah. All right. Well, it was a kind of a combination of academic interest and maybe a few architects that were finding things that were interesting in Cambodia when they visited there. But there was a guy named Bill Grieg. He was a student of architecture at Yale University, and he went to Cambodia and fell in love with these modern buildings dating from about 1955 to 1970. At the same time, there was a kind of a rising interest within Cambodia in this architecture. And there was a publication that came out in in the 1990s, that was a kind of relook at this kind of Renaissance period in Cambodia.
Well, what did these buildings look like, and were they drastically different from the past?
Well, they were concrete. They kind of tried to address local climate and local forms, but I would say most strongly they were influenced by European modernism, particularly Le Corbusier. So if you, in your mind, can picture East-West Center, you're seeing some of the kinds of architecture. And just like East-West Center, when I.M. Pei designed that, which was also 1960, the architects who were part of this new movement, mainly this guy named Van Molivan, who was quite elderly now. He was born in 1926, but he's still alive. He moved from his house in Phnom Penh, which was kind of preserved during the revolution and during the Civil War of the 1970s, and he was able to get it back. And now I think it's being used for commercial purposes as being protected. But he moved up to near the monuments to Siem Reap, and he always saw his architecture as kind of, you know, reaching back into the past. He was interested in the relationship of the buildings to water, the open spaces. And so it got to be known eventually as a result of a book that was published in the early part of the 2000s by Helen Ross and Daryl Collins, and it was called The New Khmer Architecture.
Uh-huh.
So that's what it was about.
And was this an urban phenomenon, or was it taking place in forests? And
it was largely urban, but there were a couple new towns. The most famous people would have heard of, which is near the seacoast, which is called Sihanoukville, and he did the layout. So it had a kind of urbanistic aspect. And even the school in Cambodia, which was called the École des Beaux-Arts, they had a faculty of architecture and urbanisme, which was kind of the French notion that it's all integrated.
But these buildings just do seem so striking because there'll be these, giant corrugations of the rooftop, for example, you know, these pitched things all.
He tried very hard to kind of
curves and turns.
He tried hard to incorporate things that I think were kind of spoke to Khmer people. One of the projects I liked the best was one he did for the National Bank of Cambodia, which was called 100 Houses. And he kind of reached into the vernacular traditions of raised stilt houses, which is something maybe we need to consider more in our culture nowadays after the Houston tragedy. But they were all elevated and they were very modest. He introduced a few modernist elements and they were laid out on kind of a grid. And they're still there. You can see them in Phnom Penh. And there are a number of his buildings.
Do they look dated? Do they fit in now?
Well, they look in disrepair, I'd have to say. They're not managed very well anymore. And in fact, that's one of the tragedies. Just as the time this architecture is getting recognized, just as there's literature about it, there's even a kind of niche market for people who they'll travel from New York and Toronto to go visit this architecture, and there's even a little tour business that goes to look at modern architecture.
As Doko Momo Hawaii will go, right?
Exactly, but there's a permanent possibility, and it was actually featured in the New York Times travel section one time about fun things to do in Cambodia.
Well, just following this person's
this the vision of New Khmer architecture? I mean, it started before the Pol Pot regime and then came in afterward. And so it kind of straddled this
Well, I would say it ends
period.
It ends with the Pol Pot.
Oh, really?
Period.
Okay.
So it's 1955. It's really connected to Norodom Sihanouk, who had many, many different roles in Cambodia. He was actually appointed king in the 1940s. He stepped out of that post in 1955 and let his father become king. And at the same time, he got elected prime minister. And then later he would become, when his father died in 1960, he had himself appointed head of state, a kind of new title. So he had a lot of vision. He made interesting films. He promoted poetry and theater. And so this whole culture was really part of this movement. And as you said, 1970 was the Lon Nol overthrow of the government, which was backed by us. And then in 1974, Phnom Penh fell to the Khmer Rouge. And it was occupied by the Khmer Rouge and sort of depopulated between 1974 and 1979. They had a prison there that's still on the tourist trail. It's in a modernist building that was a school.
Well, we'd love to be tourists there ourselves, and thank you so much for introducing
us
to that. But, you know, we're following this whole modernist architecture idea to Lihue as well, and that's coming up a lot sooner.
Yes.
Next month, Dokomomo Hawaii is going to be taking folks over to Lihue.
Well, we're going to meet them in Lihue. Hopefully, there'll be a lot of people from Kauai attending as well.
Great.
But, you know, we have been on Oahu because that's where most of us and where so many modern buildings are. But in Lihue, it's just got this wealth of modernist buildings, and it's all concentrated in a walking distance, which is why we decided, you know, why not? Let's try it.
What are some of these buildings?
So one of my favorite buildings there is the Lihue Library, which is done by Stephen Oyakawa, who also did the Liha Library and Aea Library. So he was a student and an associate of Frank Lloyd Wright and Taliesin. So you can kind of see that little organic architecture influence, and that's just I think his third and last library that he did here. And I think he passed away early because we can't really find that much information. I know he has a son. But anyway, so it's so dramatic. It's really wonderful. And the other one of my favorite buildings is the Convention Center.
Oh, yeah. Distinctive building. Huh?
Yeah, it's really distinctive. It kind of looks like a tent structure in a way. It just kind of like billows on the top, and it's held down in corners, and which allows for a lot of big space in there. And it's done by this architect, Clifford Young, who's a local guy, but he worked for Ian Pei, as a matter of fact, too. So, you know,
there are gems out there that we just need to know about, to look for. And there are a few in Honolulu, too, that I just want to spark people's eyes to look out for. The IBM building, maybe.
Right. Yes.
The Occidental building on Beretania.
Yeah, that's a cool building.
Yeah. So there are so many of these great buildings to be proud of in Honolulu and on the neighbor islands. You can find out more through the Dokomomo Hawaii website, or check our website here at Hawaii Public Radio. There's a tour coming up on Kauai as well as to Cambodia we think you might enjoy.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
How do you explain racial hatred or unreasoning hatred of any kind to children? The increasingly polarized mood of the nation, intensified by the events in Charlottesville and their aftermath, have created a dilemma for teachers. How do you model civility when there are so few examples of it coming from our nation's leaders? Civil Beat education reporter Sue Von Lee went into the classroom to find out, and Civil Beat editor Patty Epler is with us with that story. Hi, Patty.
Hey, Chris. Good to be here. Thanks.
You know, the whole educational environment, especially in recent years, has been about kind of protecting students of all ages from things that might be upsetting to them. So that kind of adds to the challenge post-Charlottesville, doesn't it?
It does, and I think teachers throughout the country, but here in Hawaii as well, are finding that they can't really protect the students anymore, even the young ones, and that they need to find ways to start talking about some of these issues that are becoming so sort of in our face now with, you know, all that's going on television and in the news and whatnot.
They are pretty inescapable, aren't they?
They really are. We have CNN on 24 hours a day here in our newsroom. You
sure.
guys probably do too. And it's just like incredible, you know, all of the media coverage of every event. And, you know, these kids and their teachers obviously are, and their parents are obviously watching it all too. And so I think they're discovering that there needs to be a way to have an honest conversation about it and put it in perspective.
And, you know, there's also an honest conversation to be had about not just about what's going on today, but what has gone on in American history. You know, the whole we're seeing efforts to sort of sanitize history, you know, tearing down monuments and things like that without necessarily acknowledging, you know, some of the things about the American past that aren't that palatable for young kids.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting in Suvan's story. She interviewed one teacher who actually has now started his curriculum in the present time and works backwards till he gets to the Civil War as a way to kind of bring it relevant, you know, make it relevant to what's going on today, the past, what's you know, link the two, the past and the present together.
As we talk about racial strife, both historically and in the present day, we're doing it in a racial environment here in Hawaii that's different from any of the other states, isn't it?
You would think so. I mean, I thought it was interesting that one of the teachers reported that her kids think that Hawaii is kind of a racial paradise because of the, you know, intermarriage here and there's so many cultures mingling together. But she started really showing them that is not the case. And I think that was an eye-opener for some of these 14-year-olds.
We certainly flatter ourselves that we're a racial paradise, but there are a number of things that come our way that make us question that, aren't there?
Yeah, I think so. And as you've probably, you know, listened to our podcast Offshore that really dealt with that in depth. And it's just not the way that people kind of have this vision of Hawaii.
Well, it'd be nice to have things be the way we envision them, but it doesn't always work out that way, does it, Patty?
That's so true, Chris.
Thanks very much.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed being here.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring editor Patty Epler. It's no secret that large public works projects often end up costing more than they're originally planned to be. So the recent completion of the first span of the Governor Mario M. Cuomo Bridge, replacing the Tappan Zee Bridge across the Hudson River, on time and on budget at a cost of $4 billion, gave New York Governor Andrew Cuomo something to crow about. He gave much of the credit to the so-called design-build process, whose adherents say it streamlines the procurement process, prevents the kind of runaway costs that have plagued projects like Honolulu Rail. We asked Tom Diersbach, Vice President of Hensel Phelps Construction, to help us understand just what design-build is.
Design-build is an alternative procurement method to the traditional design-bid-build process that we've been using for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And it was created to basically streamline the process of getting a building completed by integrating the design and the construction into one single source, having one team that provides an owner both the design and the construction thus eliminating an owner from being in between the architect and the contractor. Mm-hmm. So it's just an alternative procurement method that is out there that probably gets used on maybe 30 to 40% of the projects across the country.
Design, bid, build means that by the time somebody like you, a contractor, comes along, you're essentially told what it is that the client or the government, whoever, wants built.
Correct. And there's usually very little involvement by the contractor until that point. So typically in a design, bid, build, the owner and the architect produce a set of documents that the contractor doesn't see for the first time until it comes out to bid.
By which time a lot of things are locked in terms of,
Correct.
Of cost.
Correct. And you lose some of the factors that a contractor can bring into a job, their expertise on construction means and methods or materials used or a better mousetrap, if you will, on how to build something. And sometimes when a design happens and you don't have that expertise in the room, you are totally reliant on the designer to come up with a way to put it together.
But you, so under design, bid, build, you as a contractor might be asked to build something that you know from your expertise could be done in a better way.
Correct.
Design build strikes me as kind of saying to a contractor, solve the problem for us.
Yeah, and I think it brings the point of it is to bring the right people together with the right expertise so everyone's resolving problems and creating things in their own position, and they're bringing their best efforts forward for the team. It creates a lot more collaboration mm-hmm. between the group, and therefore things usually are done more efficiently, more cost-effectively. It's usually a faster process.
Is design build how you have operated all along, or have you done it both ways?
It both ways. It's really up to an owner on how they want to procure the work. Mm-hmm. Different regions of the country use design build differently. The mainland, California, West Coast is pretty big on design build. Probably half of the projects there are design build. Hawaii still mostly uses the tradition of the traditional
design bid build.
Correct. Uh-huh. And is what we see the most. But some of the University of Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, are starting to come out with some design build projects. So it's slowly evolving here in Hawaii as well.
Your company is, I'm not sure if I'm using the right word, certified to be a design build operation, or how does that work?
It really is design build is usually selected based on qualifications of the company and the experience that you have in the design build process.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding design build, there's not necessarily a official certification. There's the DBIA, Design Build Institute of America, that kind of champions the standards, if you will, or best practices of, mm-hmm. of how design build works. There's consultants out there as well that do the same thing. But as a company, basically to survive in the market that we're in, you have to offer an owner different ways to procure their job and different depending on how they want the involvement they want in the project.
Makes sense.
How fast they need it built. There's different characteristics of budget, time, depending on the type of project, which procurement method actually makes sense for that particular owner. So we have to be flexible as a large general contractor. You have to be flexible in the market when, up to a third of the projects out there might be design build.
Is there any way to quantify which one is more costly, which one is more, it takes longer? I know the data is probably all over the place.
Yeah, it comes down to the project. Obviously, if something needs to be done quickly, if there's a problem out there or it's an industry that requires something that's built. Speed is more important than money, like building a casino or building a data center, or maybe there's a bridge that that collapsed that needs to be rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes the speed of the construction and efficiency of that is more important than cost. However, you know, there's studies that show design build. You know, initially maybe there's a little bit more cost, but at the end of the day, because the contractor and the designer are one team, the involvement of cost throughout the project at the end of the day might be comparable.
In just that hypothetical that you just mentioned, a bridge that had collapsed and needed to be built, would design build be preferable in a situation like that? Needed to replace something that you needed right away.
Yeah, because it's fairly definable on what's needed, and for a contractor and a designer to come in and work together as one team, working together to build the most efficient. Contractor can bring to the table what materials are readily available, what's the fastest process to put the bridge in place or mm-hmm. direct the bridge. All those expertises can come together in a design build fashion. The collaboration with the owner group and the stakeholders in the project through the best practices of design build promote that teamwork that makes the job more efficient and likely gets the job done faster, because the drawings don't necessarily have to be 100% complete. You can start construction. There's mm-hmm. there's a lot of benefits to it than traditional waiting for the design, waiting for approvals, going out to bid, that whole process. So,
has it worked out well for you, design build?
Yeah, I think a lot of owners are excited about design build. As long as they understand it and work collaboratively with the team, I think they get pretty excited about it, because it's something that if they have a project that sometimes takes them 5, 7, 9 years to mm-hmm. to get from thought to getting it done. It's exciting for them that they can get it done a lot faster. And in an investment environment, they can start capitalizing on getting their money back. So it's a alternative process that works in certain environments.
Tom Diersbach is the vice president of Hensel Phelps Construction. It's Friday, which means we read your letters and emails and play back your phone calls to us. We've been covering various aspects of rail all week, and several of you called and wrote to tell us what you think.
Hi, this is Helen Walker. This is regarding the rail. They should stop at Middle Street. They should never actually had it at all. I did take a tour of where it would end up on Nimitz. It's awful. I don't think people can imagine what it would look like going alongside these beautiful old buildings that we have on downtown Honolulu. Mayor Caldwell should be ashamed of himself for insisting that it finish at Ala Moana and going through an image. Stop the rail now. Thank you very much.
This is Carla Sachi. I'm calling from Kona. As regarding the rail situation, I gather that they had voted on this before the final environmental impact statement came through, shoved it through like a bunch of crooks, like a bunch of sleazebag crooks that are paid to play. And I think that it's disgusting, that kind of money changing hands for something that may not even be valuable at all, especially to the outer islands. There are other ways that this can be done, a shorter rail system, more research toward different types of systems that will decrease traffic right now.
My name is Sue Bennett, and I'm calling from Lower Puna on the Big Island. My concern is that people are extremely short-sighted to not see that visitors are our lifeline, and if they have a really unpleasant, stuck in traffic, can't get anywhere in Honolulu, they will go elsewhere on their next vacation, and that every visitor benefits the entire state, and that people can only do so much and see so much on Oahu. They say, honey, let's fly to Maui. Let's fly to the Big Island. Let's go to Honolulu and then go on. So to not see this as the future for our children and grandchildren is very short-sighted. Rail and mass transit on Oahu benefits the entire state. Thank you.
Annie Peterson wrote, I support any funding that'll get rail built. In my opinion, Oahu made a big mistake back in the 70s when rail was put aside because of the cost. Driving on the roadways makes it evident that alternatives are needed. For me, it's a quality of life issue. Thankfully, I live downtown and my commute to work is generally under 10 minutes, but I really feel for those living to the east and west of Honolulu. 20 years ago, when living on Hawaii Island, I tried to make the case to deaf ears that corridors should be designated for future mass transit and, in the meantime, be used as bicycle paths. There seems to be a lack of forward thinking, and planners only considered the low population and rural landscape. Back on Oahu, transportation woes are terrible and will only get worse. Rail is desperately needed, and it's surprising that so many don't see this reality.
Following Tuesday's segment with Dr. Nitta, Charlotte Sarms wrote, the interview with Noe and the Hilo OBGYN doctor today was so real and raw. I really hope there's a follow-up to this. The drug problem and how it relates to family and the homeless crisis is very real. Please continue to follow this.
After I spoke with Lou Cooperhouse at the Rutgers University Food Innovation Center, we got this from S.A. Jones. Quote, more and more farmers in Hawaii have become landlords. Their land is fallow while they build illegal rental shacks and, quote, Costco condos. There can be 10, 20, or more people living in these dangerous structures while the owner claims a huge agricultural tax break. Instead of barely breaking even growing food, a farmer can easily rake in thousands of dollars a month in rental income. Meanwhile, government officials make excuses about why there is no oversight, but the reality is unsuspecting renters, desperate in a housing shortage market, are living in substandard buildings while the state of Hawaii is losing valuable farmland to greedy landlords posing as, quote, farmers.
Thanks for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, which is 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Hi, it's Francis Lamb. This week, we talked to Chef Jacques Pepin about what roasting a chicken can teach you about life. And why is the tech world trying to turn vegetables into meat? Don't miss it. It's The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters from APM.
Saturday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
And Friday's a day we like to check in with our news director, Bill Dorman, about what the news department's working on for the week to come. And what with Labor Day coming up, it's maybe a good time to look at the history of the labor movement in Hawaii.
Yeah, aloha, Chris. I know you're a big history buff, and the sugar strike of 1946 is something, and it's one of those things that people may be familiar with, or, oh, right, I know that. But to look into this in a little more depth, first time, really, that workers successfully pulled together across ethnic lines, able to put a united front to the plantation folks. At the time, a place, 28,000 sugar workers looking to organize. The hourly wage for most of them was 24 cents an hour. Now, in today's dollar terms, I did a little calculation on this, adjusting for inflation, that would be the equivalent of about $3.32 an hour. Minimum wage in the state of Hawaii now is you know, $9.25 an hour.
Right.
So really, and that was just part of a much broader story.
And pre-1946, the workers, for one thing, were kind of kept separated along ethnic lines.
Exactly.
And didn't feel that they had that, you know, all hands linked together unity that makes a labor union powerful, right?
And there were previous attempts. I mean, the 1909, going back to 1909 is the first, 1920 was another, 1924 was another, that were attempts to organize that just were crushed. And part of that, mm-hmm. exactly what you're talking about, in terms of splitting that along ethnic lines.
Yeah.
But this, after the sugar, came the pineapple workers the following year, then the dock strike a couple years after that.
Right.
But really, that sugar strike is so key, and so that's a closer look at that is a big part of Labor Day coverage, actually.
That's the one that pulled on the thread that unraveled the sweater, right?
Exactly right.
And we've been looking at the legislature all this week, but next week we're going to talk to the governor.
Yeah, so
Governor
Ige's out talking about, we're led to believe it's going to be a wide-ranging remarks. Rail, you know, you got to deal with, but some of the political aftermath maybe following the special session. We'll see where that goes. Wayne Yoshioka will be on top of that. Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to be doing that Labor Day story. We've got Noe in the mix on some other stuff, and we'll just have a full week of news.
Well, and inevitably with the Houston flooding, we have to sort of think about what the local impacts would be, how flood insurance works.
It's true. It's a real opportunity to sort of, whenever people see something like that, feel something like that, you know, the natural reaction is to just sort of, step back and think about that vulnerability. We'll take a look at that.
Thanks very much, Bill. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
Today, we took a look at an architectural design that was inspired by the Art Deco era. After its completion in 1927, the Waikiki Auditorium War Memorial became training grounds for the U.S. Army after that Pearl Harbor attack. It was refurbished after the war and turned over to the city and county of Honolulu, where it was a public recreational facility and generations of Hawaii kids learned to swim there. But the condition of the memorials deteriorated over time. It was closed to the public in 1979, and it's been untouched for the last 37 years. Today, we explored the memorial's past, inspired by the Art Deco style of the time. It included blocky forms and the geometric type thing and the curved ornaments on top, but always the aim was a monolithic appearance. Now, these artistically inspired buildings were all the rage of the time, and it was architect Louis P. Hobart who designed our memorial.
And Noe Kelly Tomioka of Kailua got that right, and congratulations, Kelly. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Hawaii Pacific University, and Ulupono Initiative.
We've spent some time reminiscing about Kaka'ako this week, partly because with all the changes going on, people can't even remember what was there 2 years ago. Well, Adele Balderston's a place-based storyteller from Kailua, Oahu. She's got a BA in New Media Communication and a Master's in Geography, and she's combining these skills to tell the stories of, right now, Kaka'ako. Adele's walking tour is called 88 Blocks. That's the area of Kaka'ako, and incorporates storytelling, reenactments, and projections onto buildings. I met Adele just off Cook Street recently to help us all get more of that gritty Kaka'ako vibe.
Well, you know, I don't know. How am I going to best get the feeling? Is it through these buildings or what?
It's probably more through the stories.
Okay, give me some.
Let's see. My person from the 20s talks about how this was all filled in. The south side of Oahu, the shoreline is completely man-made. Mm-hmm. It all used to come up almost on Juana Boulevard. It's like, or the coastline.
The marshiness?
Yeah.
Kind of, mm-hmm.
When they were doing the dredging, it started in Honolulu Harbor, and they dredged Kiwala Harbor later. At the Bishop Museum Archive, they have photos. So they just pulled up these hoses, and all of, like, the coral and sand and everything they dredged, they just kind of, like, opened the faucet and just let it all fill all this area in, because it was just mud flats, just water. It's almost like they tried to build a new place on top of an old place, but there's, like, pieces of the old place poking through, you know? And you can see them in the bits of the buildings.
You know, I heard that, like, in the maybe 40s, maybe even earlier, there were a lot of, like, fight clubs standing.
Yeah. Okay, let's walk to this location, because some of the boxers practiced in a gym that used to be down the street. They had a bunch of boxing clubs. There was one in Kauai Hau Church.
Huh.
And then there were, like, different decades of boxers, too. Like, there were a bunch of boxers in the 30s, and then there were a bunch of boxers in the 40s through the 50s. One of the characters, he talks about how they formed a gang to fight the Fort Armstrong soldiers. Yeah, it seems like there was a rivalry between Palama Settlement and, you know, Kalihi and Kaka'ako. Because kind of similar socioeconomic group.
You mean rival gangs?
Yeah, pretty much. But then later they kind of channeled it into something more positive. They formed the sports teams, they had the Barefoot Football League, they played softball. And so the area was rezoned as industrial in 1940, and that's when they started building these Quonset huts. And they would have knocked down all the houses a lot sooner if the war hadn't happened. It's funny because some of the land use, even though, like, the buildings are different, a lot of the community activities in some ways are the same. Like, there's kids that practice karate up there. Or judo, I don't know which sport, but I heard them. One of those warehouses with the corrugated roof was the Kiwala Athletic Club. So it was a stable, early 20th century, like pre-20s, and then when more people had cars and less need for horses, then they turned it into a gym. And it became like a clubhouse, so like community associations would meet there, but then it was a boxing gym too. And so boxing was super popular, but it was actually illegal until 1929. So it was kind of an underground sport here. But a lot of people say that, you know, the organized sports is what kind of put an end to the gang culture here. But the reputation stayed with the neighborhood.
So I'm just trying to picture everything, everybody. What was the ethnic mix?
It was mostly Japanese. There were a lot of Hawaiians, too, but a lot of Japanese fishermen. And then there were a lot of Portuguese as well. And some Filipinos and Chinese.
Uh-huh. You know, you're a geographer. What do geographers do with this kind of information?
When I look at the historical land use, I try to use it to make better decisions about the future. So, like, when you look at all of the stuff about the water level and how, you know, all of this was marshland, it's really low. It seems like a lot of it has all just been kind of temporary solutions, and now we're building on top of it again, and we're getting these king tides, and, you know, climate change is happening. It's kind of worrisome, especially down on the other side. The Howard Hughes buildings, they're only building it, they say they're building it like 8 feet above grade, which isn't enough because the inundation scenario for I think 2050, it's already 15 feet. So I don't know how long people are planning to live in those buildings.
2050?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know. I also see there's still a lot of inequality, you know, like it was a... It's a really poor area. It was raised because it was, you know, urban blight. Urban planners thought it was ugly, so they got rid of it. But now we're having the same problem. They're building all this luxury housing. But, you know, there's still people who live here, and there's businesses here. And the businesses are their own communities in a similar way, I think, some of them anyway. But it's just the cycle of displacement that's still going on.
What's it like here now?
It depends which part.
Yeah, this part.
This part, it's pretty quiet, but during the day, it's, like, still really industrial.
Still plenty auto, body, auto.
Yeah, those are the common sounds.
Windows.
But you can tell it's all mixed together. It's, like, the industrial use within the condos. But then, yeah, there's, like, a dentist office. There's a hair salon over there.
What if you, like, massage places?
Yeah.
Bars?
Yeah.
Restaurants?
And it's funny, too, because you can't always tell what it is from the outside. So there's a lot of secrets. And there's a lot of alleys still, too. Like, a lot of people talk about the Awai that runs under the Blaisdell now. Mm. So other people are becoming aware of different, you know, things that are less visible in the neighborhood. And they're trying to bring them to the surface in different ways through their actions and their stories. I also wanted to collect stories from people, because whenever I do the tours, people always come up to me after with their own Kaka'ako stories. So I am going to have, because the, you know, we have like a hub set up in there. We're going to have map posters for sale. But we're going to have a table set up, like a recording station, and I'm going to have a Google Voice line that you can call to leave stories, any Kaka'ako stories. And then I'm actually going to turn that into an installation at the Nano Gallery in Linakona in a couple months.
Oh, super!
I guess by sharing these stories, I hope I'm creating some kind of connection between the place and between, you know, current or potential residents, so that they care about it more, so that they become more active.
Hope you enjoyed our tour of Kaka'ako. 88 Block Walks is an ongoing series of walking tours there. There are two going out this Sunday, 7:30 and 9, with projections and actors. You've got to sign up, though. Look for 88 Blocks. Find out more on that website or through links at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
And that's it for this week. We are off on Labor Day, but coming up next week, we'll look at the way factional politics affect the work of the Hawaii State Legislature with a longtime observer.
That sounds great, Chris. Plus, we'll sit down with cast members from UH Kennedy Theater to talk about the latest production, Spitfire Grill.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HRI Conversation.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or maybe links to more information, head to The Conversation page on the HPR website. That's hawaiipublicradio.org.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Tuesday and pick up the conversation.